We're recording this session so that the students in Buenos Aires who won't be with us today can at least track a little bit of what we're talking about. Since this will be much more discussion than last time was more me laying out a bunch of things, I'm not so certain how well this microphone will pick up people from that end of the table, so when we can move it a little bit more, if you want to just move it a little more towards the center. But speak up a volume when you talk. So I think this first week the interrogations were really pretty good. If you've read through them all, you can see that some of them were more conducive to generating items on the agenda than others. And that's, I think, how you should think about the next round of interrogations. You know, some of them I read, and it wasn't so easy for me to figure out what exactly we were supposed to talk about, or the person wanted to really talk about. There wasn't any place that it really posed a clear and sharp question. So I did my best in distilling agenda items. The agenda is meant to be a kind of rough guide, not a severe constraint on what we talk about. And I think, and I've done some loose groupings of some of the specific issues that people wanted to talk about under more general rubrics. I think the way to proceed, it's 4:30, for us to just start going down this list, and people, I put names associated with various questions. The usual routine that I follow is when we get to an item that has your name, I ask you to elaborate and repose the question, since you hopefully will have read the entire set of... here's your... where did I put it?
It's not here.
Okay. Now you're official. So one of the things you can do is to repose your question in light of having read all of the interrogations, and to give it some substance to kick off a discussion. The discussions, of course, should not be simply questions and answers to me, although I will, from time to time, give more extended elaborations of points as I feel that would be helpful to push the discussion along. The idea, however, of course, is for this to be a full-blown, ordinary seminar discussion, even though it has this peculiar character of being built around a single book, of which I'm the author, and I'm eager to get your feedbacks. Nevertheless, I think from the point of view of how we run these sessions, it should just be a regular discussion. This is the text that provides the launch pad for a discussion on a range of issues. So the first item on the agenda concerns various issues connected to the normative foundations that were laid out towards the beginning of the chapter, and in particular the concept of social justice, which I propose, and its connection to this idea of flourishing, human flourishing lives as a way of thinking about what we care about with respect to justice. So let's just begin going through that. So the first item that I distilled around that theme was from Julia's interrogation: how should we treat the problem of ideological disagreement about social justice? So if you want to elaborate a little bit about what you're interested in, and then we can proceed.
I guess I was thinking that there can be disagreements about, you know, how we define social justice, as in the example of libertarians who would say that property rights come before, you know, having you know, minimal material comforts. But it seemed like there is also space for there to be disagreements, ideological disagreements, about how to achieve that goal. And I was partly thinking of a classmate I've had who's a classical economist, and I think is also believes that she is interested in accomplishing some form of social justice, but does sincerely believe that unions create unemployment by making labor overly expensive, and that you know, welfare creates, you know, unemployment by giving people incentives not to work. And so in that conception of things, in the long term, we would be decreasing social injustice by doing away with these institutions that don't allow the market to function as it ideally would. So I don't share those beliefs, but I wondered what the objective criteria are for distinguishing between ideological approaches to achieving the same goal.
I think that was one of the thoughts I had a lot along the way with the goal of emancipation, because I was thinking the whole Iraq war could be defended from the point of view of emancipation of people, and it was a very, from that perspective, it's that goal that's very good. But then when you look at, so you could say social justice, there's a problem with social justice in Iraq before the war went in, but then if you look at the other, there were those three sort of layers of the way to look at things, is the alternatives and then
desirable, viable, and achievable.
Yeah, and for me, that's what made, that's what allowed, because I think even people who disagree with the war in Iraq, or who disagree, or who think unions or not unions are the right solution, may have a more similar base point that they're starting from than they think. So I think the nuances in whether unions or not unions is the way to achieve an outcome enters into those next categories. Do you know, like,
into the next category?
Into the, like, the debates about that are around the viability and achievability.
It's like you start off with the ideology and then you go into the practical elements.
So social justice, I mean, the unions is a means to achieve a goal. It's not the goal in itself.
Right.
So part of the evaluation of social justice, like with the example of unions, would be, like, will unions achieve the goal or not? And that's where you and your friend differ on not on the social justice, but on the way to get it.
So it's a disagreement about ends, not a disagreement about means and the way that you should. I guess one way you disagree with somebody is by saying you're factually wrong, right? That in fact unions will produce better outcomes and welfare or whatever, right? That I mean, obviously it's not so simple to do that, but I mean, that's one way to look at it, is that that's where the kind of the, right? That's the kind of the social science comes in, I guess.
Now, are you really convinced that your roommate and you share the same ideal of justice and simply disagree in your theories about how the world works to achieve it?
Yeah, I think that would be open to discussion too. But I was trying to think my way through that, and it occurred to me that probably part of that neoliberal classical economics argument is that some human suffering is probably okay, and some human non-flourishing is an individual's fault, right? Which would maybe be a separate definition of how we picture social justice. So that would be a fundamental difference too of the ends. But I wonder if we're also going to consider imperfect ways of reaching those ends, then that sort of leads to the question I ended with of, so someone there might argue that welfare reduces, you know, people's moral standing, even though it provides them with material benefits. So how do you judge amongst imperfect versions of what it is you're trying to achieve?
One thought on this, on the issue of the ideological dimension of these disagreements. It's often a strategy in ideology to mask a difference of principle with empirical claims about how the world works. And those empirical claims always have silent conditions of possibility. So it may be that if we say we keep everything else the same, we don't change the basic power relations of corporations the basic democratic rights of people? And we just asked the question, do means-tested welfare programs encourage people to struggle to get out of poverty or not? Or do they create incentives for people to withdraw from the labor market and live at the level of welfare? Well, if you set the empirical constraint such that you can't change anything fundamental in the system and all you're talking about is that particular policy, then, you know, I think there's a reasonable empirical case that welfare as we had it created all sorts of perverse incentives. The left was opposed to those kinds of welfare programs until they came under such assault that it seemed that the alternatives were going to be worse. So, it's not like the miserable, means-tested, dignity-eroding welfare programs we had in the United States, which were designed to stigmatize. You know, they made people go to places where they would get labeled and stigmatized to do it. It's not as if that was what anybody really wanted. There is this character that you set up the game such that it's bound to fail and cause problems, and then you draw the conclusion that it's better not to do anything and just let the market run. So you have to be really careful in discussions around social justice issues of this sort to really carefully disentangle what are the empirical claims, what is being treated as a parameter of the discussion, not subject to critique. You know, imagine your roommate in that discussion wasn't asking the question, is welfare means-tested, stigmatizing, perverse incentive welfare better or worse than full employment with active labor market policies that retrain people throughout their lives to be flexibly able to earn a living which requires considerable government intervention. Now, that wasn't the comparison. But I also think there really is there are pretty deep disagreements over the concept of social justice itself, over what people really believe versus the thin versions of what they say they believe.
Yeah, I think maybe you can set up the same discussion for every concept in this first chapter, like democracy. It's also like there are some concepts that are taken for granted in some discussions, like social justice, democracy, or freedom, for example. That it's difficult in some settings that someone will say, no, I'm against democracy, or I'm against freedom, or I'm against social justice. But at the same time, everybody has a different notion. So it's also a matter of the book, I guess, to whom it is talking, or in which debates the book is trying to participate. That takes this concept, like democracy and social justice, that are also taken for granted by other political traditions, and maybe that's something to discuss, how well these notions are differentiated from other traditions that take democracy or social justice or freedom. I don't know if freedom is there, but it's this kind of, I don't know if it's like lost idea of empty notions that you can take democracy and you can put anything there.
I think the expression social justice already has a pre-notion in it that freedom doesn't have, that's societal. Mm-hmm. Like, social justice for me is a concept that you can't have. It's harder to have social justice for one person than it is to have freedom for one person. It's something that comes more. But I definitely think that there's an agreement that not everyone agrees that mm-hmm. social justice is a necessary aspect of society.
But I also think that there's a lot of people who would look at these two definitions and think that that exists in America today. Like, I think that they are broad enough and people have so many different ways, it could be interpreted in so many different ways, that, which is why I think it's like so important to go beyond that, to get into like how the ideas behind this will actually be played out. Because I think I have had conversations with people who, like, from that individual standpoint, and I don't know whose comment was, I think Rudolph, I think it was yours, about how, like, you know, the right can say that, that, you know, if the individual has access to it, then if the individual doesn't accomplish it, then it's the individual's fault. And I think that people could look at this and say that, that people do have access here, even if they don't take advantage of.
No,
I don't know.
I think, I mean, part of the task of a radical critique and establishing the normative foundations is to interrogate the superficial ways that people, the sort of soft focus ways that people talk about these things, and to show why they're not satisfactory. So, for example, I argue that the social justice criterion is equal access to the necessary social and material means to live a flourishing life. Now, the word equal and equal access, there's a lot going on in that word. Some people would drop the word equal and say a just society is when everyone has access to the means to live. So if, as long as kids have access to public schools, that satisfies the justice condition. So it would be unjust to bar some children from schools, to say you know, to say in order to go to an elementary school you have to pay $1,000 a year, and if you can't you're out on the streets. That would be viewed by most Americans, would say that's unjust, it's unfair to those poor kids that they can't go to school. But if you ask them, is it fair for poor kids to, is it just for poor kids to go to poor schools and rich kids to go to good schools, and very rich kids to go to private academies that cost $60,000 a year? There was an article in the Times, New York Times, about Phillips Exeter, which said that the cost per student per year is $60,000 now for, you know, for high school. Well, that's certainly, those inequalities don't satisfy an equal access criterion by any stretch of the imagination. There's no possible way that anybody could say these children have equal access to the means to live a flourishing life. Unless you believe that the poorest of schools gives you full access to the necessary means to live a flourishing life, and everything else is just sort of surplus access, it doesn't give you any more access. You know, and some people say that. Some people say that good schools are just a question of, it's, you know, it's like a good restaurant. It's just a higher level of consumption, but it doesn't give you any more flourishing. There are people who say that.
Where are they?
So one thing is to really think about it. If you take seriously the equal access idea and the equality of it, the equal access does not mean that everybody has the same material and social means to live a flourishing life. They just have to have equal access to the necessary means. So it's equal access to the necessary means, not equal access to all the possible means. So as long as a kid is getting a full and rich and interesting education, which provides them with the cultural tools and the language ability and the intellectual diversity that they would need to fully become a, you know, cognitively complex adult, being able to read and understand things, then if some other kids in addition to that are getting, you know, fancier gyms, well, the fancier gym you might object to on other grounds, but it's not because it violates the equal access to the necessary means to live a flourishing life. Because having a fancy gym or just a really good gym, I don't think distinguishes access to flourishing or not. So the equal access to the necessary means to live a flourishing life does accommodate a certain amount of inequality as being not subject to a social justice complaint. You know, there might be other reasons you'd object to it, but it doesn't reduce in any way the access to the conditions for a flourishing life. So if the only way you can get a really fancy gym in some schools is to have crappy gyms in another, that would violate the principle. But a fancy, you know, fancy gyms with shinier baskets just means you have a shinier basket on your basketball, and it doesn't in any way affect your ability to develop, you know, vibrant athletic skills of the sort that's part of a flourishing life, then it's essentially irrelevant, I would argue, for a social justice concern. You know, would it be the case that that's what we had to worry about? You know, if that those residual inequalities were the source.
Yeah.
What?
If only.
Yeah, if only. There's lots more I can, you know, it's like priming the pump, you know. there's a lot more I could say on this particular theme.
Thinking back to the question you're asking, though, is keeping in mind that we don't live in a society that is socially just. It's normal to not expect people to agree on what they expect social justice to be, or even to want social justice on the agenda, because it's an agenda for change. Mm-hmm. And so there's like the finer points to work out, but it's just also the fact that social justice is not something in general that everyone agrees on.
Yeah, but still, well, I mean, I would say two things, I suppose. First of all, that and I'm just going to pick up this general statement that Paulo Freire once said. He said that he wasn't going to talk to the right anymore, people belonging to the right anymore. Obviously, you can agree on that, or you cannot agree on that, but I sort of felt that he was saying that when you discuss with people from the right in certain topics, you end up discussing things that are kind of, what's the use of discussing that because of issues of powers and so on. So for example, like that general statement about people having to suffer a little, so afterwards their economy ain't gonna get it right. If you discuss that, for example, in a Chilean context where you need to ask, well, who were the people that actually had to have suffered all along? And what did that little suffer mean? I mean, these people keep on suffering for more than 20 years and it doesn't seem that things are gonna get better. So I do agree with you, I think, that sometimes you have to sort of define who's the community you're talking to in terms of being able to level things down in a way and say, okay, we're gonna discuss about this, but in these terms and so on. And the second thing that, but I do agree with you, is that, and you talk about Nancy Fraser, actually, that I think that when you talk about the material basis of social justice, it can become a bit more easier than when you go into issues of recognition and participation. I think that's when things get really messy in a way, or really confusing or difficult. Because on the other hand, I do see people that are in favor of new forms of distribution, but just to get more consumerism out there. So to become really, have a really flourishing life is to be able to access to all of these new forms of technology and that come along with other different forms of racism or sexism. So I think that when we think about what we're going to do with the money in a way, just to make it really simple, I think that's when it comes really, really difficult. Because I see, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I see people saying, okay, we need more equality in terms of economic income, but not precisely to build a more collective society, but just a more individualistic society. And that's the way my life is going to flourish, because I'm going to have all these commodities and so on.
It's also the case, of course, that one of the stakes in the politics of recognition is distribution. There's the if the two were really separate, fully separable. The advantage of changes in the politics of recognition is it doesn't cost you anything, right? So to speak. It only costs you something if, in order to have a full politics of dignity and recognition around race, for example, would also mean redistribution from the rich to the poor because of the way race gets connected to poverty. And so it's the, where I disagree with a little bit with Nancy Fraser, is I think a lot of the resistance around questions of recognition comes from the well-founded understanding that if you take recognition seriously, you have to redistribute resources. And it's the redistribution of resources that people really object to. The ideological disagreements about social justice are often really conflicts between interests and social justice. No, social justice means there's going to be people who are going to lose. There's got to be redistribution. There's no way to have social justice in any real world without significant privileged and advantaged people losing privileges and advantages. It doesn't mean they can't live a flourishing life, but their privileges and advantages are above what's necessary for a flourishing life. They have, you know, way surplus consumption with respect to this problem, access to the necessary social and material means to live a flourishing life. And they're going to lose that, and people get pleasures out of those resources, even if it's not necessary for their flourishing. They still like it. And they resist social justice not because they really have an alternative view of justice. So it's not so much a genuine, heartfelt disagreement about what's just. It's selfishness and greed versus justice that's in play. But nobody wants to say it that way. I mean, you know, a wealthy person doesn't want to say, I'm just a pig and I don't give a shit about anybody else, and the reason why I oppose this is because it's not good for me. End of story. Ayn Rand said that's the end of the story. I mean, her view was the selfish egoist is the highest form of humanity, and it doesn't matter what the consequences are for other people. Mm-hmm. You are your own boss, and you should pursue your own interests. End of story. Mm-hmm. But most people feel uncomfortable with that stand.
Yeah, this is sort of where my question was coming from, I think, because it seemed like flourishing is defined in such a way that it's sort of like a low bar that everyone should be able to agree on, in a sense. And it seems like in what you're saying now, that's... So the idea is that if you define flourishing in such a way that everybody really thinks, even the libertarians think that flourishing is what we should want, and then you can sort of argue about institutions and which institutions will create flourishing, and presumably we can show, you know, let's just say for the moment that we can show that... you know, free markets don't produce flourishing, and that real utopias do, and so we have this kind of neat argument that says, well, you like flourishing, you want flourishing, everybody wants flourishing, equal access is necessary, and therefore we need a new set of institutions, right? What worried me about that was that it seems like then flourishing becomes so open-ended because it's such a, I don't know if low bar is the term, but it's such a, it seems like it's a design so that everybody can agree with it. And then it seems like it risks becoming sort of nebulous and what is it really? And so I kind of felt like I wanted, like, well, here's a list of 3 things or 7 things or 12 things that, rather than sort of one thing that's contained in social justice. So it's, you know, autonomy at work, and it's something about education, and it's, you know, whatever else would be on that list that don't necessarily have any common feature. I mean, they might, but they wouldn't have to. Then you risk disagreements with, say, libertarians or whoever, and that raises another set of problems. But in a way, it's kind of, my concern is kind of the opposite of Julia's, where I feel like it's trying to dodge ideological disagreements rather than confronting them.
I think if you had a list of 10 things that you were concerned about with respect to social justice, the problem would not be that you'd have disagreements with libertarians. You'd have disagreements with everybody. I mean, everybody would disagree with everybody about the rank ordering of those things, about the trade-offs between them, about the criteria for the egalitarian criterion with respect to one when it interferes with another. You know, it would lead to a kind of incoherent stand with respect to the problem at hand. How do you design institutions that move us towards a more just world? The issue is not that everybody agrees on flourishing. I mean, libertarians like to flourish, communists like to flourish, everybody likes to flourish. The question is whether you agree on the equal access to the social and material means to flourish as being an imperative of justice. And libertarians would emphatically reject that. No libertarian would say that anyone has a right to the social and material means to live a flourishing life. They would categorically reject the notion that you have a right to that, or that its distribution is of any concern. What they would say is that you have a right to the fruits of your own labor and to your property. You have a right to that. And nobody has a right to take anything away from you that you have legitimately produced and earned. That's what they would claim. You have this very strong right to private property so long as it wasn't acquired through fraud or force. And you have the right to anything you produce with your private property so long as it wasn't produced with fraud or force. And so if somebody takes something away from you in order to increase other people's human flourishing, that's an injustice because it violates your essential autonomy rights and property rights.
Sure, but I think some libertarians might say that, I mean, obviously that's sort of the bedrock principle on which libertarianism is built, but a lot of libertarians might very well say that, well, if you just let free market principles operate, you will get a world in which there is human flourishing. Some libertarians might not care, but the point is that there's the demarcation between real utopians and libertarians.
Right, but the libertarians who recourse to the Milton Friedman argument that in fact this is the best way to make everyone flourish, it's because they're weak-kneed in their principles. That is, what they're doing is saying, I'm going to fight on two fronts. One is a philosophical front which says taxation is theft, and another is the empirical front, taxation is stupid. So if I can't convince you that it's theft, well, maybe I can convince you that it's stupid. So that if you're a socialist, you should support capitalism because capitalism is a better way to realize socialist goals than is socialism. These are two completely...
What makes that weak-kneed? What makes that weak-kneed?
Well, because they basically realize that they're the real reason why they are object to taxation is that taxation is theft. That's the principled reason they object to it. But a lot of people think that's a ridiculous argument. They just don't buy that view of property rights. The other argument is a really vulnerable one because there's plenty of reasons to disagree with the view that unfettered capitalism is the best way to improve human well-being and human flourishing. And there's tons of evidence that that's it's a very weak empirical argument. So when I say weak need, it's because a lot of libertarians try to defend this strong libertarian autonomy private property argument, but I think a lot of them in their hearts realize that that's not a philosophically sound position. Particularly with respect to the problem of children. It's pretty hard to argue that on the basis of this property-based view of rights, that there's nothing problematic with respect to fairness and justice for some children to be born into poverty and others to be born into wealth, because they bear no responsibility for who their parents are. Just one last little thing, just while we're, since I invoked children. another way you can think of what's in play in some of these social justice discussions is that people hold multiple principles about what's just. Not one, they hold several. And everybody holds more than one, and the question is, what do you do when they clash? So an example would be, most people, I think, feel comfortable with the idea that there's something special about the bond between parents and children, which give parents the right to try to do well for their children, to give their children a good life, and that it's reasonable for parents to put special effort into nurturing and developing a flourishing life for their children relative to the effort they would put for other people's children. And that's partially because of our intuitive sociological understanding about the nature of parent-child bonding and what a family is. But it's also somehow viewed as the parent's right to do that. So most people don't feel there's anything that violates social justice for a parent to spend a lot of time reading stories to their children, even knowing that not all children will have access to good quality story reading from their parents. That I'm not acting unjustly by doing a lot of story time with my kids. And most people feel that, I think. There are philosophers who argue that for every hour you spend reading stories to your children, you have a moral obligation to read to children with parents who have parents who don't read children. You know, that's the only socially just way in which you can give those special advantages to your children is to give them to other children as well, be that as it may. So then what you do is you, given that intuition, but it's a socially just act to take care of your children well and to nurture them. It's not very far to move from that to if you want to spend your income to give your children an extra special education, but you can read stories to them, why not send them to a better kindergarten than other kids have? And et cetera, et cetera. So then that parents can confer advantages on their children is viewed as not unjust by many people. On the other hand, they could also believe that equal access to the means to live a flourishing life is a principle of justice. So these two principles clash. So you got two principles, the familial principle of nurturing your children and doing whatever it takes to give them a good life, and the social principle that all children and all people should have equal access to the means to live a flourishing life. And then the question is, when they clash, which one, as the philosophers say, has lexical priority, which one should trump the other? And that then becomes the kind of subject of social justice disputes that I think are not covers for some other dispute. They're genuine social justice disputes because these are two principles of justice which most people would hold, with each of which has good philosophical grounding, and in which it isn't so obvious how you jigger them together. Yeah.
So when you talk about social justice, to me there seems to be, there needs to be some idea of protection. So taking the example of a parent, which a new parent, but if I have my child and when I decide to feed my child or my children, and if from a standpoint of social justice, I don't have an opportunity to be made aware of the food in which my child is consuming, right? So speaking particularly about biogenetically altered food, right? So I have a right to give my child the best opportunities to grow and become a functioning citizen of the world, so to speak. But if I'm without the ability to be made aware of which drugs that my child may need that aren't, approved by the FDA. There are lots of drugs out there that are on the market that aren't approved yet. And something like biogenetically altered food, in which there is an illegal right for these companies to make the consumers aware of which foods are altered, then how am I to be, confident that there will be justice, so because if, say, something happens to my child, cancer or something, several years from now, that originated from something that I had no idea that was harmful to them, and I, I'm reading to her every night, but by the time she's 12, she's hooked up to a respirator because of something that I didn't know about, and I had no legal right to know. So what part of social justice?
And that certainly, that a world in which these things are problems for parents is a world without equal access to the means to live a flourishing life. As with respect to a dependent child, you are the agent who gives that child access to the means to live a flourishing life. You're the intermediary. But if you're deprived of the necessary information because of structures of power. I mean, this would be a case where the existing structures of power over the allocation and use of economic resources is the, that's where the diagnosis would come. So this would be an example where we would diagnose a particular feature of capitalism, which is the private control over information with respect to all sorts of things. And one of the harms that that generates is a bad distribution of information and a difficulty for parents, in the particular case you're talking about, to get access to the necessary information to help their children flourish.
Or even be made aware of what is harmful to them.
Right, that's what I meant. The necessary information about the potential harms of different right. choices. And so that's definitely an example of an injustice along my first dimension, around social injustice. Now, it may also be just an example, not of an injustice, because everybody may be deprived. That is, that social justice is a claim about inequalities in access to the means to live a flourishing life, not about the level of access that everybody has. So if everybody is being poisoned, right, then there's no inequality in the access to the to clean food, let's say, because everybody is eating lousy food. You wouldn't describe that as an injustice. It's just a public bad. Not all the critiques of capitalism are on the grounds that it's unjust. Some are just that it's universally harmful. And universally harmful is a reason to criticize something, but it doesn't. It's not a social justice criticism. Social justice is about the unfairness across a population of some desirable property. This is just about the harm to the whole population of some undesirable feature.
But in your scenario, there are still people who have the power to make decisions that are negative for everyone. So there's still an inequality there of power, and there's still, to me, that is not a just system.
Right. Yeah, so that would fall under my political injustice, because remember, political justice is equal access to the political means to fully participate in decisions that affect our collective fate. And that would be an example. Private property in general violates political justice because it gives some people access to the means to make decisions that affect our collective life and excludes others. And this would be a very special, very particular example of where some people have the power to make decisions around what the toxins are in our food, and other people are excluded from access to the process by which those decisions get made. The particular power aspect of it, I think I would place that under the rubric of a political injustice, where political doesn't mean just the state, it means participation in the collective decision-making process.
And yeah, also because I would say that the people who made the decision to put the toxins in the food were not consciously making the decision to put toxins in food, they were making a decision that for whatever reason was more gave them more money or was easier for them to bypass the system. And so I don't know if the awareness of the... So I think, yeah, I guess I would agree that it would,
but I just think
it would be a different reason.
For me, it helped a lot to understand social justice as in there's a high chance that if you're born in X family, you will not obtain the same average outcome as people born in other groups. Was probably the easiest way for me to understand conditions that prevent flourishing. So whether it's like the race or income group or whatever you're born into, for me that was the best way to understand where social justice does not exist.
But I agree with that. I think
they're caused by.
But it's important not to think of social justice as just about children, about where you're born. I think the reason why people who talk about this often invoke the children problem is because it's so poignant, since they bear no responsibility over their parents. And therefore, the inequalities and the lack of access to the means to live a flourishing life are so patently undesirable and unfair. Unfair in the ordinary sense of just unfair. It's an additional move to say it's unjust, but for the moment, that it's unfair seems clear. But I think social justice is a lifelong issue. It's unjust for middle class people who hit hard times and go bankrupt because somebody got sick and had to sell, foreclose their house. That's an injustice as well for adults. I mean, that's also, by the way, I prefer the term equal access to the means to live a flourishing life over equal opportunity to live a flourishing life, because the expression equal opportunity is consistent with a lottery. I mean, let us suppose that at age 20, we have a national lottery, and you either get, if you win, you get $100,000 a year for life, and if you lose, you get $10,000 a year for life. Everybody would have equal opportunity to have the material means to live a flourishing life under that system, but people would not have equal access to the means to live a flourishing life. And I think the term opportunity is sufficiently vague on this issue and suggests that what's called sometimes starting gate equality is all that matters, or that a lottery, as long as the lottery isn't biased, as long as there's no cheating and it's not rigged, then a lottery is perfectly fair. Therefore, those of you who are into the philosophical discussions, that's why I use the equal access notion. My view is it's part of a family of views about social justice that is an opportunity view. So I don't believe that justice demands that everybody have the same standard of living, for example, or that everybody flourish, just that they have equal access to the means to flourish. And if some people don't flourish in spite of having equal access, well, that's unfortunate, and we might want to do something to remedy that if we could. But it isn't a question of social justice then. Okay, we should move on.
So what would that differ from the sort of rightist notion of equal access that you can see from this policy? For example, schooling. Like, if we get all those kids into school, that means that they're going to be able to achieve a huge amount of possibilities and so on.
Well, I mean, the right wing's view is not that we should get all children into really excellent schools with small classrooms where we devote a huge, we have to redistribute from the rich in order to make this possible, so that all children have fully equal access to the means, the educational means to live a flourishing life. So, if we had that, and then some kids goofed off the whole time they were in school and didn't learn very much, and therefore end up in a less advantageous position with respect to flourishing, well, my equal access view says they shouldn't be punished for life for that. There should be continual opportunities and contexts where they could regain access to the necessary educational and cultural capital that they need to do well. So it's not that if you blow it as an adolescent, you're screwed for life, as it were. But it also means that if life is a little tougher for them, if they have to go back to school in their 20s to get the educational skills that they should have gotten as a teenager but didn't, we shouldn't feel it's an injustice. If things don't go as well for them as it did for the kids who didn't have those problems as an adolescent. I think there is some individual responsibility that people should have for their fates, if they're operating under conditions of equal access to the means to live a flourishing life, that people need to take responsibility for taking advantage of those opportunities, that access. And that the system, though, should be non-punitive, should be forgiving and continually renew that access. I don't know if that's answering your...
No, it does. The thing is that, I don't know if I'm doing the correct question or not, but I think that equal access, even though I agree that most of the time you hear equal opportunities, but anyways, I think that those are kind of slogans that rights policies usually use and are able to bring a lot of consent in people, because who would oppose that? So that's what I wanted to, just to think through if that expression is the best we could use, or is it just that we should
I think it's an advantage that the right uses that, because we can say, oh, well, you support equal access. Well, then we really got to take this seriously. You know, you want equal access? Okay, we've got to tax the hell out of the rich, and we've got to close down the big, rich private schools, because that's not equal access. And they say, oh, well, I didn't mean that. And then, but you said that, don't you mean it? And, you know, I think the equal opportunity rhetoric is complete bullshit, because nobody, most of the people who advocate it don't mean it. And that, but that's something they should be called on, and it's that equal opportunity, even equal opportunity, let alone equal access, is actually a very radical idea. And to really force people to acknowledge that it's a radical idea and what it would take to put it into place.
It seems like subprime mortgages would be an example of what equal access could mean. Because you talk about, you know, prime candidates for purchasing homes don't have these credit issues. So they created something else called subprime mortgages for people who don't have excellent credit or even good credit, so to speak. So when that took place, the origination of these subprime mortgage markets, what happened prior to that was a deregulation of loan activities associated with the creation of mortgages, right? So all these things that used to be illegal within each of the 50 states is now deregulated. In essence, the states can't prosecute a person for engaging in these list of activities, everything from like loan flipping to prepayment penalties to, you know, acceleration of payments and the like. So we're talking over a dozen different activities. So on the one hand, you would argue, like, hey, all these people who didn't otherwise have access to homes, now they get an opportunity to buy a home. And they're, you know, that's a good thing for everybody, because everybody wants to live the American dream. But they don't have protection from the people in which they're having to go out and purchase these homes from, because those people aren't subject to any criminal prosecution, at least within the state that they're engaging these people. So to me, if there's equal access, which these people have, they're able to go out and purchase these homes, and studies are showing that the overwhelming majority of the people who are negatively affected by this are African American and Hispanics, who have been, you know, very excited about the possibility of owning homes, but when they go to buy the home, the person that is selling it to them is under no obligation to be truthful to them. And even in doing that, if they do say something that's fraudulent.
But all of that shows that it really wasn't equal access. Mm-hmm. That is, all of that shows that it was a kind of pseudo equal access. It was equal access to the credit, to getting credit, but not actually equal access to the conditions for owning a home.
But these people, I mean, it's like you need to tell them, it's like you're saying that the people who went out and attempted to purchase homes, they were under the assumption that they're being fairly treated, right? And if it's something that you're saying, you know, in the past tense, that it wasn't equal, that obviously wasn't made aware. They weren't made aware of that at the beginning.
But from the point of view of a theory of justice, what one would say is, if you compare the subprime mortgage problem to another huge program that existed in the United States to make housing affordable to people who previously couldn't afford it, the GI loans after World War II. The difference is that the GI loans were all subsidized by the state, so that general tax revenues were being used, that is, the part of the surplus was being reallocated to support a massive extension of home ownership to people whose, on the basis of their market capacity, would not have otherwise been able to own homes. That was a program of enhancing equal access to the means to flourish, to the extent that owning a home is part of the means to live a flourishing life. Whereas the market-based solution of subprime mortgages depended for its economic viability on all these schemes that we're highly contingent upon the housing market continuing to have a rapid increase in prices. You know, that's what would sustain it, because it would mean that the equity that people would be building up in their houses would be sufficiently big as to give them a kind of wealth basis for the you know, these odd interest things.
Right. So if this layperson is never aware that there is a scheme in play, then how do you call it social justice?
That isn't social justice.
And how would they even be confident that they can trust what is put in place for them? Because if you take subprime mortgages, it'll be you know, cars next year, it'll be credit cards the year after that.
Well, the premise of my argument is that we live in a capitalist society which is profoundly unjust. It's premised on its deep structure is one of social injustice, and then the various manifestations of that in any given time will characteristically be expressions of that underlying injustice that comes from power connected to private property and profit maximization. I mean, it's a double whammy. It's really this double link. You have power connected to private property and private property oriented towards maximizing profits, so that power gets oriented towards maximizing profit. Putting those together is what creates this multiple manifestations of an unjust relationship of people to the means to live a flourishing life. I think we should just move on, just because we've spent the. I'm perfectly fine now. I'm not. This isn't in any way a comment on, you know, the things we've been discussing. But we've only partially gone through the first item on the list about social justice. We've touched on some of the other issues on the list, even though we didn't, you know, stop explicitly on them. We've talked a little bit about, I think, some of the themes. Wes's theme was a little different. It was about the stability of any social justice solution, given that there'll always be people who will.
Which ties into Rodolfo's comment a little bit, though, like, right, a common argument for, hey, alternative institutions is the moral critique, right? That, hey, there are people that are suffering, and therefore we need an alternative institution, while the book defines social justice, right, as equal access to the means of human flourishing. It doesn't guarantee human flourishing per se, which seems reasonable to assume that the best social institution that we could construct might reasonably have people that are not human flourishing and have a level of human suffering. So what's to keep in that context, using the moral argument, right? Okay, we're after the revolution, right? We're living in a socially just society, and yet we continue to have human suffering and a lack of human flourishing. I think part of the answer to that is maybe rooting our arguments in more scientific, even critique of specific institutions versus simply the moral critique. Mm-hmm. Hey, here's a population of people that is not flourishing, therefore let's go after radical change. So I guess that's all that to say. We could wait to talk about it until Rodolfo, but now I just started talking about it.
We can jump down to item 5 so that to discuss, I mean, because it bears on these same things. There's Rodolfo's comment on the tension between a moral and a scientific critique. If you want to elaborate that point, it does follow on from some of what we've been talking about anyway. So,
yeah, I mean, my point comes more from this previous idea of to what's the audience of the book and how it engages in previous debates on the left and socialist traditions. And well, I came up with this as an example of that. I didn't elaborate as much on the tension, but I guess I could say that if you take into account that tradition, I mean, the strong opposition of Marx and Engels to the moral critique, and let's base our critique of capitalism on a scientific understanding of exploitation and oppression, and how does that relates to the strong moral stand of the book. I mean, if it's a discussion with that tradition, I mean, coming back saying, okay, the scientific path to emancipation wasn't as successful as we thought it would be, or maybe both, maybe a moral justification of a scientific analysis, or, I mean, I don't know.
What does a scientific critique mean unless it's linked in some sense to historical materialism and some justification for the inevitability of capitalist collapse, right? I mean, that's sort of what, in this context, scientific critique means to me is, you know, scientific critique in opposition to a moral critique.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you say, well, scientifically we know that capitalism is going to die, then I can see how that's sort of divorceable from some sort of moral sentiment. But if you think that, in fact, it's not necessary that it could happen or could not happen, then it seems like a moral, some sort of moral argument is more necessary. And it's also, I mean, Marx said he was opposed to moral critique, but if you read Capital, there's all kinds of moral statements in there, so.
Well, I don't think I would associate the scientific critique with some prediction of the end of capitalism. I think what I don't know what we're necessarily talking about when we say scientific critique, but I think a moral critique would be on the basis of some sort of universal moral or ethical principles, and a scientific critique would be something along the lines of a proof that says that exploitation exists, that it's inherent in the system of commodity production, and that if that system were done away with, the wealth available to workers would increase. That's I think what Marx had in mind in terms of a scientific argument. I don't.
Now, why is that a critique of? I agree with you.
Yeah.
I think that the crisis theory is a particular way of playing out how you would get from capitalism to an alternative, but that the critique of capitalism is of the sort that Ido laid out, that is, it's a critique based on a scientific account of exploitation and its consequences, and then a counterfactual, in effect, of what life would be like in the absence of that. But the question still is, why is that a criticism of capitalism? Why is it a bad thing for capitalism to be harming workers?
Well, it's not. It's, as you said in the last session, it's on the basis that it would be better for us. And
right,
but
Marx isn't a work. Right, right. So yeah. Why would Marx give a shit about this? Or Engels? Engels is a capitalist.
It's the moral critique.
So why would Engels say, this is bad for workers, therefore I'm going to support socialism? But what possible reason would Engels have for supporting socialism if it was the only argument for socialism was that it was good for workers?
Well, I think they would say that you know, anybody so conscientiously moved is welcome to board the train. But I think that the reason Marx opposed a moral critique was because he didn't think it could be sustained on principles of universality and morality, because he knew that, you know, Marx had this firm conviction that blood would be spilled if there was a revolution. I don't think he thought you could justify that on the basis of a moral critique. I think he certainly had a lot of moral outrage. Marx had no end of moral outrage towards capitalism. I don't think he thought that was an argumentatively feasible track to take when attempting to free people of their false consciousness or whatever it was that their endeavor involves.
But another way of saying that is just that moral arguments don't play well. Which is
that's not
a serious justification for.
It's
I mean, that's a contingent
It's a strategic justification, it's not a philosophical justification. I think that's all Marx had in mind, for at least from what I know.
But then it's not. Then there's not some sort of profound issue about scientific and moral critiques. There's just this contingent fact about strategies and who Marx and Engels were.
I mean, how I understood the difference between moral and scientific critique is that a moral critique, you have some absolute idea at the end, and that a scientific critique is like, it's like following, it's like starting from a point and seeing, it's like, it's a method, it's more about the process of figuring out what's wrong, but without some sort of, it seems more like means versus ends in terms of like a, and I don't know about the whole Marx Engels thing, because you guys obviously know a lot more than I do, but
for me the moral critique is the whole why would you bother doing a scientific critique, almost, like that's the...
Well, if you're a worker, you'd have another reason. There's two reasons why you might attack capitalism, I think.
It's bad for our interests.
It's bad for me, yeah. You know. So, for the same reason, if we were living in feudalism, that a proto-capitalist will attack feudalism. Say, I'm opposed to feudalism, damn it, because it's bad for me. My capitalist firm can't thrive under feudalism. Let's get rid of feudalism, so to speak.
And addressing other capitalists, let's overthrow this thing, because if we do, it'll be better for us.
For us. And in addition, then saying, and besides, they just inherited their privileges, and that's unfair. We work for our privileges, and that's fair. Right? So you then add, as a way of building a sense of self-righteousness, not just self-interest, in your mobilization and in your solidarities, you add a moral gloss to it, which is not phony, because it is true that in feudal society you merely inherit your power and privilege. In capitalist society, certainly in early capitalism, you had to work awfully hard and you took risks and a lot of attempts failed. So there was a sense in which capitalists who succeeded, even if they also exploited workers, took all sorts of risks and put their, you know, their careers and their fortunes on the line all the time. So they had a justification for being self-righteous about why capitalism is better than feudalism. So workers in capitalism can say, let's oppose capitalism, try to transform it, because it'll be better for us as workers. Those of us who have nothing to lose but our chains, so to speak, in the Marxian, you know, rhetoric of the Communist Manifesto on that. Workers of the world, unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains, you have a world to win. I mean, that's a pretty attractive reason for overthrowing the system. If you have the whole world to win and you have nothing to lose but your chains, that's pretty good. The question then, I think, is whether that's actually a persuasive reason for marginalizing arguments around social justice in a context where it is no longer really the case that one can say you have nothing to lose but your chains and a world to win, where there's so much complexity in the nature of people's locations with respect to systems of production, where the notion of alternative is much more problematic, people think it is, and therefore the kinds of coalitions and the kinds of mobilizations needed, a lot of people think, need to be driven by something other than self-interest. That if it's just self-interest that's driving it, then the reasonable thing for a person to do is to make a calculation about, well, okay, it's just all I care about is my self-interest and that of my fellow workers. What is it going to cost to get there? How much better will things be there? Is the transition trough between the two worth it, given the time horizons? If you make that kind of calculation, is it ever going to be worth struggling for an alternative on purely self-interested grounds, as opposed to on moral and social justice grounds, in which case making sacrifices for social justice can be justified, even if you don't personally benefit from it. So I think the argument for a social justice case is partially that even for workers in a more complicated world, they need motivations for struggling for transformation that justify the sacrifices. And if the only justification is that you're going to do better, if it's just an investment model, then it's pretty unlikely that it'll be justified. So you need whereas moral justifications give you all sorts of reasons to stay the course and make those sacrifices. And you're appealing to a much broader circuit of people. The iconic Engels, so to speak, you want him to join the train. Well, there's a lot of Engelses, so to speak. I mean, not capitalists, but just whatever we mean by middle strata and middle class.
I think you focus more on the political program or how to create a movement, and I was talking about the critique and how do you identify the suffering or the problems with the system, and I guess that was my point, and how do you identify if you start from the moral critique or if you start from an analysis like you said of exploitation or.
But I don't think there's a tension between those two starting points at all. That is, when I say the first task of emancipatory social science is diagnosis and critique, the diagnostic part is entirely scientific. That is, you diagnose these institutions by identifying what are the causal processes in their structures which generate these harms. And the social justice argument is a way of bolstering our confidence that what we're calling harms are really harms. That they, you know, that they're not just accidents, they're not just facts of nature, that they are harms being generated by these institutions. So I think that there isn't really a tension. There's a tension between a moral critique and an interest critique. Those are really often conflicting motivations. Acting on one's material interests and acting on one's moral concerns can often pull in the opposite directions. But I think both interests and moral critiques require scientific analysis. Requires a scientific analysis to know what's in your interests. And people often blow that one. You know, they have lousy understanding of how the world works, so they act against their own interests. And that's true for capitalists as well as workers. They work under very bad theories about what would be best for themselves. But the same is true for the moral critique. You know, people can have very good faith, good-willed, progressive senses of social justice and really care about the well-being of children and their prospects, and just have very bad understandings of how existing social institutions and structures block solving those problems and have, you know, crazy theories. I mean, I think a lot of people who believe that one of the reasons for the plight of young, poor African Americans is, you know, teenage pregnancy, and believe that abstinence only will actually improve the lives of people, they're acting in good faith. I mean, it's not that they actually want to keep people down and keep people living in, you know, desperate poverty with disorganized lives, but they have a religiously based, unsociological understanding of the nature of the.
They're acting in faith instead of
in faith. I think we should move down to the next, you know, to number two. Just, I don't mean to shortchange. Guillaume and Eduardo had two items still on the social justice topic. But I think we've touched around on these sorts of issues a bit, so we can return to those if we get further down the overall. So why don't we do some on the democracy? I should say, by the way, that some of the questions that were raised in your notes are things that we'll be discussing very systematically in subsequent times. So particularly some of the questions that centered around strategic issues. How do you go about changing things? We're going to have three sessions just devoted to that. The chapters 8, 9, and 10, I guess, of the book are all about different logics of strategy. So some of these things we can postpone for later. Okay, so Ido, you asked a series of questions about the democracy component and its.
Yeah, I've lost context for it. The part that you're talking about there is that my thought was that when pushed past the boundaries by which it's currently constrained, a system of democracy would, I think, begin to infringe upon the basic ways in which capitalism operates. It would begin to take away private decisions about how investments is made, and put it in the hands of some sort of collective decision-making process. So I didn't know whether, I mean, we hadn't gotten to this discussion about different types of transitions, but I guess the question would be, if we're making some sort of real utopian institutional reform that's incremental, that begins in the context of capitalism, what then happens to the ideal of radical democracy? Does it get compromised, or do we work for it also on an incremental level? But I think your response answered my question in a lot of ways. I just don't remember the context of the discussion now.
Well, part of it was this issue about, which applies to the social justice issues as well, whether it's logically compatible with capitalism.
Yeah.
So you postulate social justice and political justice, and are these being defined in such a way that it's necessarily the case that you could not have capitalism and satisfy those conditions? And I think you were suggesting that a fully radicalized radical democracy of an egalitarian sort does seem incompatible with the private in private property, given that collective consequences flow from the allocation of those resources, they would have to be under collective control, under the stipulation that what we mean by a radical democracy is equal access of people to the political means to participate in those decisions that affect their collective fate.
Yeah. Insofar as radical democracy is the instrument by which you achieve political justice, as you defined it,
right,
I think it is incompatible with capitalism.
And my response then, just to remind people, was to make the distinction between a sort of capital C capitalism. Radical democracy is certainly incompatible with an economy that's organized on capitalist principles, versus an economy within which there are capitalist niches and components where there's a certain space for capitalism, and whether that's incompatible with radical democracy. And there I argue that it's not necessarily incompatible. The radical democracy could be compatible with some space for capitalism within the overall structure of an economy. One joking way I put it is that there's no reason in principle why in a radically egalitarian democracy the democratic process couldn't decide that capitalism between consenting adults is okay. In the privacy of their own homes. So that is, I can...
stretching the definition of capitalism.
Well, I can just imagine, you can imagine that,
yeah,
you have a deeply democratic process in which people are discussing, well, how are we going to allocate resources, what are the priorities, and they say, look, for small restaurants, it just seems that they work better if you just let people save their own money and open a small restaurant and hire people to work there. We're going to regulate the conditions of work, the minimum wage, the ability of the workers to organize. There's going to be some co-determination and some discussions, but it doesn't have to be a full-blown workers' co-op always. Some people can have a good idea for a small restaurant. There's no reason for us not to have that kind of capitalism, small firm capitalism around particular local markets. And then people discuss it and debate it, and they say, yes, it does seem that the equilibrium in which we have big sectors of the economy organized in a socially empowered socialist way with these then specialty niches for particular things, it just seems to work better capitalistically. Well, there's no reason why that couldn't take place and be consistent with a radical democracy. One view is that if you allow a little, a little bit of capitalism is like a little bit of pregnancy. Grows.
Yeah.
And then if you allow a little bit of capitalism, it will ultimately corrode the egalitarianism that is and make it unsustainable. Yeah, Eduardo.
Yeah, but I would maybe not but just I would. I may turn to that question. So would democracy be possible in another kind of system, which is just saying this general discussion that I don't know, maybe because being able to own something, you sort of relate that to freedom, so freedom relates to democracy, and the only places where this has been possible. It's in a capitalist society where people can own and then be free and blah, blah, blah. And especially when I recognize I'm a son of a Western system. So when we, the grand narratives that we receive from the Eastern countries or even Cuba is under socialist regimes that because people are not allowed to own, they are really co-opted, constraining their freedom rights, blah, blah, blah. So what I want to say, could you make the other question, how will you solve the question if you turn around? Is it possible to have democracy in a country that's not capitalist?
Well, of course, there's lots of defenders of capitalism who argue that you can't, that it's a necessary condition for any form of stable democracy that you have capitalism and markets. That's Milton Friedman's argument. And he points to precisely the cases of centralized authoritarian, what I would call statist economies, as proof that you can't have democracy under those conditions because you have too much concentrations of power. The state has too much power because of its control over the means of production as well as over the political means of collective action.
Well, we know that capitalism functions perfectly well under autocratic regimes.
Right.
The question then is whether democracy will only function under a capitalist regime.
Friedman's argument is it's a necessary but not sufficient condition for democracy. And that socialism doesn't provide even the necessary conditions.
Yeah. But I think that, I mean, that the view that, I don't know, as I understood it, the view that private property creates some sort of enclosure that allows people to accumulate a source of social leverage or power that is in opposition to the autocracy of the state, I think comes from a deeply bourgeois idea that the state's role is an interference upon, you know, your free economic actions, and the whole thing is embedded very deeply, and I don't know, probably inextricably, from capitalist social relations. I don't know that, you know, I'm not saying it very clearly. But.
We will return to this theme quite a bit, I think, when we discuss social empowerment and the state and the particular formulation of socialism that I'm proposing. The way I would interpret the critiques of socialism from the vantage point that you just laid out that they're actually critiques of what I would call a kind of concentrated statism. That it may be that it's not a stable possibility to have a highly centralized statist economy that would also be robustly democratic. That combination may not be institutionally stable. But I think that's quite different from saying that you couldn't have a socialist economy, that is an economy within which social empowerment over the allocation and use of resources was the dominant way in which economic activities was organized, that couldn't be stably connected to democracy. There's nothing in that concept of socialism that says that people can't own anything. It's just that they can't hire people. It's what you're not allowed to do is to use whatever you own as a way of exploiting someone. That, you know, people can have houses, they're going to have bicycles.
You can hire someone, you just have to pay them the value of the labor.
Well, you can hire them, and you can hire them under the condition that they become members of some kind of cooperative, mutually empowered, you know, socially empowered enterprise. So you can put up the capital for some small firm and get a bunch of other people to join the firm as members of what's then a cooperative. But the rules that would regulate the governance of that firm and the allocation of its revenues and its surplus would be ones that would mean that you wouldn't be exploiting any of the members. You know, all that's very tricky, exactly how that would be, what it would work, and that's another question, but it would seem to me that if anything, from the logic of democracy, which is empowering people to have the capacity to participate collectively in decisions which affect their lives, a decentralized socialism of social empowerment of the sort that I'm describing is more conducive to democracy than is private ownership, because it creates more arenas under which that kind of empowerment is possible.
I actually have a general question about the nature, maybe this notion of the power, because the in the definition of the political justice, you made that if the brutal legal access to the necessary political means to collectively control those decisions sounds like it's kind of tautological, because the every resources and means to and access is can be a resource of political power. You know what I mean? Because the every resources can be a political means. So what do you mean the political means and equal access to the political means? For example, just you know, the nature of the power is basically the hierarchical. So you're saying that the removal of the power is the goal of the democratization. Or actually, you actually made that in another part the against the Foucault's and Bourdieu's view of the power. But the on the other side, you know, there could be just you know the possibility of the risk when you actually develop our the notion of the this democratization and at the extreme can be concluded to the very small size of the city, like removal of the state or the centralized kind of institutions and concluding to maybe the communitarianism, things like that. So how can you actually do
it? I do not want this notion to devolve into a kind of anarchist view, which argues that there can be no centralized forms of power, no hierarchy. So equal access to the political means to participate in collective decisions is not the same as eliminating all layered and hierarchical sites of decision making. The question is whether people have equal access to those sites. That is, to participate for some things that means to participate in elections, for some things it means to participate in meetings from which delegates get chosen. It doesn't mean that everybody gets chosen. You just have equal access to the political means within which power gets allocated. I mean, just one simple example would be if in the city of Porto Alegre, they have these neighborhood assemblies around the budget. Two people from each neighborhood assembly get chosen for the citywide budget council. That citywide budget council makes the final decisions about the allocation of budgets that get produced from these assemblies. Now, that's hierarchical. Means that that much more restricted and limited citywide council has a lot of power, and people get disappointed as a result. Well, I don't think that violates the principle of equal access, because anybody can go to that assembly, anybody can vote in that assembly, and anybody in principle could get elected. It's not that everybody has an equal chance of getting elected, because some people are scoundrels, and some people are idiots, and some people you know, have morally relevant attributes with respect to why you would choose somebody for a delegate. What you can't do is bribe people, you know, so you wouldn't have equal access if it's the case that somebody can go in there and buy off everybody else. There was a question here.
I think I'm struggling with something, and I'm not sure if there's something, if you are exerting an underlying assumption, or if it's an assumption that I bring to these readings and it just reflects upon how each person will then take these readings. And that underlying assumption is, you know, what is exactly is the motivation? What is our end goal? So, for example, for me, the end goal is, well, what is best for the collective? Julia's friend's end goal, since she said, oh, you know, unions keep late expensive labor. So she looks at her friend would look at capitalism and the players in capitalism as just as important as the collective. And then getting to Guillaume's question, I think, about social justice and whether it's about individual rights, it's about collective rights, you know. So I guess I'm just trying to, like, everything that has come up is kind of, you know, when we talked about libertarians versus socialists, and we're talking about all these, I think there's this underlying real, whether it's this universal morality that we're trying to get to, or maybe we have to admit that we're can't get to it, maybe we assume that, I don't know, maybe that doesn't make sense and I'm not able to articulate it, but I don't know if it's just my assumption that I bring to the reading, that the collective is a goal. Because we can always say, like with political justice and democracy, well, is it always the case that there has to be representation for, you know, all viewpoints, or, hey, is it good enough that majority rules? And as long as everyone has equal access to, you know, giving their input or voting, then majority rules, majority rules. I don't know. Does that?
Yeah, Todd, and then before I
clarify,
no, that's a good
Todd,
point
you're good at that.
Oh, well, I have a completely different question.
Okay. Hold yeah. your point. If there's other people who'd like to respond to, you know, what Sung-ok and Charity are sort of tacking around some related matters.
I guess I would just have a question, I guess, based on that, is that could we work toward change without an idea of a goal? Like, is that possible? Could we see improvement without knowing, without having a goal in mind? Which I don't know if that's kind of what you were saying,
yeah.
but... Which I think my answer is yes.
If the word improvement implies that you have a criterion for it being better, which implies yeah. you have a goal, it doesn't mean
but
you have a destination.
But I think you can have a criteria for being better without an ultimate utopian view.
Right, you may not have a destination in mind.
Right.
You may not know exactly where you're
going
to end
up. You can
up.
Have criteria, right,
but
without it.
Who is of our true interest? Is it that, in the end, each individual is our true interest, or as... in my mind, and that it's the collectivity is always, in the end, the interest.
Charity, you're saying that different arguments for our end goal or a destination, they'll be different if your priority is the you know, what is best for the individual as opposed to what is best
right.
for the collective?
Because perhaps, going back to Hani's example, perhaps those rating agents or the people who are doing the loans, they can say, well, it's my right, and, you know, I'm flourishing because I'm able to sell these houses, you know, whatever. It's legal. you know, so then is that okay?
But I think social justice is like a really specific, like, parti pris, like a political project.
I think so too, but what we're seeing, especially in the first hour of the discussion, is that maybe that's not so cleared up as we believe, because maybe perhaps the people we sit at tables with have a common understanding and have that common assumption.
No, but then it's a political project. Sorry, I take for granted that people don't agree with me, right? And it's something that you have to... Either some people will agree with you easily, because they're like, yeah, or they won't, or they'll be like, no, I just like it the way it is. Thank you very much. And that's what I mean by political project, is you have to build up the underlying goals of it.
There is a really important conceptual issue in play here, which I think leads to lots of unnecessary confusion in these discussions, which has to do with invoking things like it's in the collective interest, but not the interests of individuals, right? So I don't think there is a collective interest, except insofar as individual human beings flourish under what we're calling a collective interest. And that ultimately what matters is that people's lives go well in whatever dimensions we want to evaluate it, in which flourishing then is one convenient language for talking about that. You know, there's other, you can talk about well-being, welfare, happiness even.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing has to do with the individual rights versus institutional rights. That is, I don't think it makes sense to say this is a just institution, because it satisfies justice principles, unless it is also the case that by virtue of it being organized this way, we have social justice among the people who live in those institutions. That is, that they have equal, you know, in my formulation, an institution will be deemed just if it is the case that it contributes to realizing equal access to the means for the people who live in that institution to live a flourishing life, the social and material means. So when we say about the collective interest, it's certainly, I mean, I certainly reject, for example, a simple-minded majoritarianism. We know that majorities can be dreadful with respect to sexual minorities, racial minorities, religious minorities, and they can do all sorts of things which are profoundly unjust.
and ultimately undemocratic, because they would violate my, they would violate, oppressive majoritarianism violates my definition of democracy, because it denies people equal access to the political means to participate in the collective decisions which affect their common fate. That's why if you really play out this notion of political justice, it requires a dialogic, you know, deliberative kind of democracy where you struggle to reach deeper forms of consensus, and where you can't, you kind of keep track of where people are losing out on these consensus problems and try to compensate in various ways, rather than have permanent minorities that are always getting screwed by, you know, the failure of consensus. Now that's a lot of work, that's really hard, and democracy will always be fall short of some perfect ideal there. But I don't think it's helped by invoking collective versus individual.
Right. But at the same time, for every individual's equal access, that equal access of the collectivity has to be certain. But anyway, that's a whole other philosophical discussion.
We're triggered. By the way, it should say liberty and not rights. I probably didn't send you the last version. What triggered my interest with your formulation is that access is a liberty to obtain something. And so the way I saw what you meant by, or what is meant by justice, is an equality of access, but also an equality of outcome. Not the outcome as living a flourishing life, but an outcome as being able to use the material. And so, given that resources are quite limited, I didn't see how all individuals would be able to obtain and use the means. I understand and agree that some people might never want to take part in a collective project of social justice, and that so it's their right to not use, or their liberty not to use the institutions of public justice. That's why I thought I tried to phrase my interrogation about institutions being like kind of the bearer of social justice, not the individual.
Catherine, are you responding to this? Otherwise, I'll.
No, go ahead.
Okay. I guess I still don't quite understand why the institution is the bearer of justice, as opposed to the institution is the means for achieving justice. But the justice is still a justice in the distribution of access to the means to live a flourishing life of individuals. And, you know, if an individual who has full access to the necessary social and material means to live a flourishing life drinks themselves under the table and doesn't flourish because of alcoholism, and in spite of having access to the clinical and medical means to, and the therapies available to deal with this, they don't. Well, they don't flourish, they squander. But they don't have a social justice complaint. They may have some other complaints. They may have a complaint against their parents for being nasty to them or something. They may have a complaint against the medical industry for not having a better therapies for alcohol, you know, whatever. But they wouldn't have a social justice complaint, even though they didn't flourish, because they did have access. And that's what I'm trying to identify, and it's still individual access that is what counts as evidence that either the institutions are or are not just.
But can you not see that there's potential conflict between individual trying to have access? They're exercising a liberty to obtain something.
Right, but if
you can take, for example, the daycare in Quebec. The system is universal, is equal access, but not everyone is able to get into it because there's a huge waiting list.
Yeah, but that's because not enough social resources. Yeah, that's a case where you don't in fact have equal access. some people are denied access, some people have access, and that's because there's a failure to redistribute resources from wealthy Quebecois.
Well, they're not that wealthy.
Well, there are. There are plenty. You know, Quebec could afford to have a daycare system where everybody had access, actual access.
Could afford?
Yeah, yeah. Sure it can. You know, it's not that expensive. So when I say the necessary social and material means to live a flourishing life, it doesn't mean the necessary social and material means to do whatever you want. It's to live a flourishing life. And some people are going to have their wants blocked because they won't have access to the necessary means to do whatever they want, but they would still have the necessary means to live a flourishing life. Now, if you believe, for example, that a necessary means to live a flourishing life is to own a Hummer, you know, some people may believe, well, then that there is a problem then of scarcity, because we cannot possibly provide everybody with the access to the necessary means to acquire Hummers. But I don't believe it is the case that in order to flourish, we are the kinds of creatures that need Hummers. And somebody might believe that, but they're wrong. It's incorrect. And it may be then, it could be that there'll be some injustices, residual injustices, because some people may have such expensive tastes, such, you know, extravagant forms of flourishing which they care about, that an egalitarian society would of necessity have to block their access to those means. And that, you know, that may or may not ultimately be a problem. I think people's preferences around or beliefs about what they need to flourish are endogenous to the social system. We're in an egalitarian society, there will be people who believe they need huge wealth to flourish, whereas in an egalitarian society, people won't believe that. So because preferences are endogenous, you know, and people's beliefs about what they need to flourish are endogenous, my expectation would be that under egalitarian conditions, the scarcities would be less pressing with respect to access to the necessary means to flourish. But that could be wrong, you know. If that was wrong, then there'd be a problem.
But as long as there's any sort of... Sorry.
What?
I just talked instead of, you know.
Well, I just want to, I mean, so if I understand sort of the tenor of Charity's comments.
Small sin. In the big picture.
Of Charity's comments and other comments, I think that what bothers some people is sort of this, what appears to be this sort of individualist kind of tone to a lot of this. And I think that one way to think about that is to go back to the question of recognition and the politics of recognition. And there, for example, it's easier for me to see how the whole does have some sort of ontological status, which is prior to the individual, right? So if you're a member of a stigmatized racial or ethnic group, and you're committed to that identity, no one benefits by the improvement of the stigma, the lifting of the stigma, or the raising of the status, or whatever, to that group without everybody benefiting, right? In the sense that the meaning attached to membership in this category is attached to every single individual that's in that sort of category, right? And so that's a case where sort of the collective has some sort of meaning that can be reduced to whatever's being distributed, in this case some intangible good of recognition.
The way you described it, you still justified the reason why we care about lifting stigma from the collectivity by virtue of how it improves the lives of the members. And it's just that this was a case where the only way to improve the lives of the members was to lift it for the group as a whole. But it's not that lifting it from the group of the whole, even if it made everybody's life more miserable, would be a good thing. That is, the premise is that removing the stigma for the category makes everybody's able, because of the recognition dimension, live a more fulfilling and more flourishing life.
Right, but if you're really thinking about it in terms of people's identities, I mean, it's sort of a question of they're not even being individuals necessarily until we've thought about the meaning of that category. And it seems like one thing to think about that in terms of these sort of cultural categories, but then if we think that, well, maybe class is also like that.
I still think that fundamentally the moral core is individualistic. That you're making a sociological point, which is absolutely valid, that there are some ways of enhancing the lives of persons which can only be accomplished by enhancing the lives of a group, of a category, of a community. And therefore, we have to work on enhancing the conditions of life of that whole community in order to enhance the conditions of life of its members. But it's still by virtue of its effects on the lives of its members that we would bother doing it. You know, I don't know why one would care about the well-being of the collective if it didn't matter for any of the people within it. Now, you know, there are people who disagree with me. There are people who say, for example, it would be better to maintain a language group, for example, not French, that's a big population, some tiny language group, even if it meant that all the members of that community would suffer more intensely, because the only way to maintain it is to block their ability to move. You know, so there are people who say that you have a minority, you have a small language, the only way to maintain it is to restrict the mobility of those people, because if they are able to leave, they want to leave, they will. And it's more important because the group will disappear if they disperse into the population. So, and we want to prevent them from doing it.
The value that's being defended is the intrinsic value of having this
language.
This language?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But that's actually what's the name of the guy who ran for the Liberal Party, who used to be a professor at Harvard?
Yeah.
I was going to say Dr. Crazy Talk. He writes about that in Quebec all the time, and that was the whole basis for, you can't protect French individually unless you protect it collectively.
Right, that's why I was saying a small language group in which all the members would suffer deeply in order to protect their language. And none of them want it, but we're going to force them to do it.
That's one of the biggest problems, and one of the most interesting problems with regards to that in Quebec is a lot of people would like their kids to learn English as well as French.
Right.
But you can't, unless you go to private school.
Well, they do learn English in school. And they watch television all the time. You know, they do learn French.
Well,
Quebec, in the cities anyway,
But that's new.
It's new.
Not for me. I started English in grade 4.
English isn't too bad.
Yeah, and I've got some friends
who are... got that charmant.
I've got friends who are very resentful about that.
Yeah.
Like,
well, I think,
that lock.
So, if that wasn't being justified on the grounds that it was ultimately better for the people involved, that their lives would go better if they made, that they have false, claim that they have false consciousness if they believe they should learn English. Actually, it's better not to learn English. I myself would oppose an argument in which all the members of a community reject that this is good for them, and the justification for it is that it's good for the group, but not for any of the members of the group. To me, that's a perversion.
It sounds like community Uber alles. It's like the Deutschland Uber alles, the fascist idea that that what was best for the state was good for people as a whole, and not what was good for individuals. It sounds like a reification of some. Crazy entity, false entity, or something, I don't know.
One quick interjection. It's almost 6:30. Time flies when you're having fun. Normally, I think it's in fact healthy practice for our collective and individual flourishing to have a break, you know, roughly at the halfway point in a seminar. I'm not sure if at 6:30 it makes sense to have a break. Sorry. I think we should just go on to... I think we can carry on the discussion, and if people have bodily needs of whatever sort...
So just to go back on... Just to go back on that point, Eric, I'd like to know what you... Like, when you talked about the radical democracy versus, let's say, a capitalist democracy, what kind of connection do you draw between freedom and justice? You talked about, like, the very interesting Porto Alegre case, and it seems like you constrain freedom to have a just environment.
In what way?
Well, basically you have a larger assembly. Not everyone has the ability probably to run for a delegate or to become like a...
No, but his definition was that everyone has equal...
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about the notion of justice and freedom.
So by freedom, you mean individual autonomy?
Yeah, the ability to
do what you want.
Exercise your liberties.
Yeah, so let's just take the ordinary liberal notion of freedom.
Yeah.
Freedom is the ability to do what you want, right? What's the relationship between my notion of social justice and freedom? So my social justice criterion is equal access to the necessary material and social means to live a flourishing life. I think a world in which you have equal access to those means, material and social, is one in which freedom is distributed more evenly in the population as well. That is, it's what Philippe Vantaris calls a real freedom for all. If freedom is the ability to do what you want, one of the conditions for being free is having the capacity to act on your wants, to put your projects into practice. And equal access to the necessary social and material means to live a flourishing life is egalitarian with respect to access to the means to put your life projects into effect. Now, it does mean that some people's freedom will be lowered. The freedom, Bill Gates' freedom, would be reduced in an egalitarian world because there are some things which he currently wants to do which he would not be able to do. There'll be more constraints on his freedom in an egalitarian world than in a world in which your private ability to accumulate power and wealth determines your private levels of freedom. So it's not the case that an egalitarian society is one that maximizes every individual's freedom. What it does is it redistributes freedom so that there's less variance across people in their capacity to do what they want. So I don't see freedom and equality as intention. The standard right-wing view is that there's a trade-off between freedom and equality. Whereas I think an egalitarian system is one, in fact, that enhances, for most people, freedom.
Well, the Platonist view as well. This is freedom and justice is being one or the other, like a trade-off.
That freedom and justice are a trade-off. Yeah. I mean, I just... If by freedom we mean people's actual abilities to make choices and act on their preferences, rather than just the fact that they're not coercively prevented from doing things. You know, some people make the distinction between positive and negative freedom in that sense. That's not such a good philosophical distinction, positive and negative freedom, but it's not a bad sort of off-the-shelf distinction. What I fundamentally care about is positive freedom, people's ability to do things, not just their freedom from being bossed around by somebody else. And capitalism has been pretty good at what's called negative freedom. Nobody can tell anybody else what to do, so to speak, unless they agree to be in that situation. But does a very bad job on distributing positive freedom. I mean, I don't know how much that addresses your concerns. Todd, you've been...
I wanted to ask earlier if juries are a problem in this, because we talked earlier about how a lottery, when we're talking about social justice, a lottery where you either get, you know, $100,000 a year, $10,000 a year, doesn't work for that. So this is a lottery system where there's a jury system where there's a lottery where you might end up on this, you know, some sort of citizens panel to decide about X, or you might not. That seems like equal opportunity and not equal access, which may or may not be a problem, but I'm just wondering if the criteria is different for political justice than it is for social justice.
I mean, I'm a fan of a certain of these new experiments that have been proposed in various places. We'll discuss this a little bit in chapter 5, I think. Some new experiments of trying to develop new systems of representation based on randomly selected assemblies rather than elected assemblies, and also rather than voluntary participation assemblies. And the idea is that for certain kinds of decisions, what you want is a truly representative sample of ordinary citizens making the choice. But it's not feasible to have a gigantic assembly with, you know, 2 million people. So why not? And you don't want politicians involved in campaigning. What you want is just ordinary people to make this decision. So why not simulate an assembly of the whole by randomly selecting a couple hundred people to make the decision? And that seems a pretty good idea. And it is, every person has an equal opportunity to participate, but they don't have equal access to the means to participate. They have equal access to the lottery, so to speak, but not. But once the lottery is done, then some people are in and some people are out. I guess because it's a random selection of people who are making a collective decision, and that if it's properly organized under deliberative conditions, it's reasonable to imagine that any random assembly would come up with the same decision. That although it is, you know, it's a virtual form of participation, it does seem okay to me. The examples that I know of then have the citizens as a whole vote on what the decision of the random assembly was. And to me that seems like a reasonable institutional balance in trying to figure out new ways of getting ordinary non-privileged citizens to be central decision makers on complicated matters. But it may be in tension with my attempt at making a careful distinction between access and opportunity as the way of thinking about the egalitarian principle.
I guess, I mean, you could also think that's one reason why flourishing falls under social justice and not under political justice.
Yeah.
Which I was wondering why that is, but if political justice isn't necessary for flourishing, then there's no particular reason, maybe, why there has to be equal access as opposed to opportunity. Well, in the particular case of juries, reason for another.
I mean, I do not feel that it is. You know, some people argue that it's a necessary condition for people to flourish that they participate in collective decisions. Mm-hmm. They actually participate. I don't feel that the evidence is very strong for that. That is, that it's a universal feature of humanity that if you don't participate in lots of meetings, you can't flourish. You know, I think there are trade-offs.
It sounded nice until you put it that way.
So I think it's trade-offs. Some people are good at something, some people are better at other things. Some people, even under the most egalitarian of conditions, are going to prefer activities that may be very cooperative and engaged, but are not involved with lots of complicated planning and decision making. You know, it's not the case that everybody's going to flourish under the same activities. And so I don't think that the homo politicus kind of view, which says that it's so inherent in our natures that we are political animals, that if you don't participate politically, you won't live a flourishing life. You know, that doesn't seem plausible to me, although it's a hypothesis. And I think it could be the case that in a world in which such egalitarian and just practices became routinized and part of everyday life and became taken for granted, that virtually everybody would participate politically because out of some combination of obligation and a feeling that this is a good and fruitful thing to do. But I doubt it. I suspect it'll always be a subset of people who find that this is really what they enjoy and feel flourishing around. Yeah, Molly.
I had a question, I guess, about political justice. Would it include not only just being able to participate in decision making, but also having access to information about decision making, so
sure.
that it, because at least in terms of the
opportunity versus access, I would say that in terms of the information, it would have to be an access thing.
Yeah, because it says access to the political means, and included in those means would be information. I don't think in the text I elaborated that, but information is an absolutely critical aspect of the political means. It's one of the problems that some of these experiments in random assemblies help solve are in fact certain information problems around decision making because of just the information overload that people would have if they had to participate individually in all of the important decisions. It's just beyond people's capacity. And by having a random selection of people engaged in some decisions, those people can become super informed as ordinary citizens, super informed about the subject matter of their assembly over a period of time, and essentially act as knowledgeable decision makers in a way that all citizens would if all citizens had the time and energy to acquire that information. So it solves what political scientists sometimes call the rational ignorance problem, that because information is costly to acquire, it takes a lot of time and energy for many complicated matters, for most people it's more rational to remain ignorant, you know, not to invest in that that information gathering process. But this solves that by sort of designating a subset of the population, but still ordinary people, as the information reservoirs for a particular kind of decision. And these assembly jury experiments, I think, that's why I find them pretty interesting as a real utopian idea. Why don't we go to the meaning of alternative and achievability and viability, because these are themes that are going to bear on a lot of what we talk about all semester. So we might have time to at least touch on both of these. Ido, if you want to remind us of your...
I might not want to.
I mean, we don't have to.
The question was, given the fact that capitalism has certain needs for its ongoing functionality and that the ideals of at least some, if not most, real utopian institutional reforms might jeopardize that if we don't have some sort of wholesale transformation of capitalism, and it doesn't necessarily have to be revolutionary, but if there isn't a rewriting of the entire structure of social relations, I think then every institutional reform that we make is in jeopardy of being undermined by the requirements of capitalism itself and profit maximization, etc. That was the concern.
That was one of the things I was thinking about a lot when I was talking, like when I was writing my response about the question of scale. Is I think one of the and also this also makes me think of question of like not everyone wants to be, you know, in parliament, like wants to be in, say there's a system of people making decisions, not everyone wants to be there, and that's fine. So where can different people fit in? And sometimes I think what's interesting is when you have regime, like say you put in place a system, it will have to battle to create a space for that system that is different than the rest of society. But at the same time, it creates it makes the capitalist system less compatible with the way things are done on a certain level. I'm having a hard time explaining this. It's a lot in political science and regime theory. There's a lot of stuff about like regime effectiveness on the international level not working unless, and this has been a big problem with the environmental regimes, is they don't work because there haven't been experiments or alternatives on the ground level that are compatible with what's done at the higher up level. So I think sometimes putting in something, like there will be struggles between what the new institution you propose and the capitalist institution, but at the same time, by making that the system that it's in irrelevant to certain activities, you're actually gaining more space for those.
Yeah, but as long as there are interested actors in the institution that's being jeopardized, that is capitalist, you're going to have some form of social conflict between those two. And
but that just creates more.
Well, but generally speaking.
In either way. But
I think there's sort of a question here. In part, I think somewhere in the readings, and I can't remember where, there was a comment on, you know, the need to believe in these alternatives and how even that can take us partway there. Like to social democracy. But I guess the other question is, does arriving at social democracy keep us from taking the next step? So are the halfway solutions also, do you see what I'm saying, where you open up a certain space, but that also decreases the tension in the system that could have led to a more dramatic change of the entire system? I feel like that's part of what you're getting at. It's like
I think it's the same concern, but it's not what I was thinking of. I was thinking of overt power struggles.
But it is the concern in the next point.
Yeah.
If you were to have a radical overhaul of a system at the national level, it would happen because there are already a lot of, I'm going to say institutions, but I really mean that at the smaller scale, which make that the logical outcome. Like, I just don't think you don't have national overhauls of political system short of military coup that is completely incongruous with the people in a place.
Well, I mean, doesn't it sort of depend on how flexible you think capitalism is? Because, like, for example, let's say that there were, you know, a reform institute tomorrow that said that all workers had to be paid a percentage of gross revenues for all capitalist firms, right? And so whether or not firms made any profits would depend on, you know, the size of revenues that particular year. So, you know, some years they would make profits, other years they wouldn't, but in general, they might continue to make profits, in which case you might think that capitalism would continue to be viable, even with this central kind of wage institution, which was radically different from anything that had been seen in capital.
But also, for that to happen, you'd have to have had a huge change in the way democracy functions already. Right? So, for me, that's really interesting.
Or you can massive increase in union. I mean, it's not that fundamentally different. I mean, it's very, very different.
The point is that, given, if let's say we struggle for a very long time to achieve that sort of arrangement that creates a much more equitable distribution of social resources, if for some reason that ends up producing a situation in which profitability and the conditions of profitability themselves are jeopardized, then it's going to lead to one of two things. Either the institution itself will be dismantled by people for whom profits are in their interest, or the system as a whole will go into total collapse.
Right, but there's an if there, right? So this, the institution I just described might or might not be capital or compatible with the viability of the capitalist system.
Well, that doesn't even need to be that institution doesn't need to be the reason for a loss of conditions of profitability. Something else entirely can be causing economic issues. That will be an immediate target.
Right.
Well, so just look at neoliberalism.
There's a scale problem, right? If one country decides to impose this policy, right, one Latin American country, Chavez puts in, you know, share of gross revenues from all companies, then capital flight sets in.
We can think of all kinds of... Sorry, cut you off.
No, go ahead.
We can think of all kinds of reasons why this might not work. But I'm just saying, like, all those are sort of empirical questions about whether or not certain kinds of reforms, maybe the thing I just described is way too radical to actually fit with capitalism, but maybe something slightly less radical would be, right?
So
it's the question, right? Is this compatible? And if it is compatible, then it's not necessarily the case that that would be the first thing to go.
So in existing capitalist, developed capitalist societies, we observe a variation between some capitalist, well-functioning, profitable capitalisms having about 55% of the national revenue taxed and going through the state, and at the high end in Sweden, to around 30% in the United States at the low end. That's a pretty big range. You know, to have a state that takes roughly half of the total GDP, a little more, versus a state that takes less than a third at all levels of the state and all levels of taxation. Now, they're both profitable capitalisms. It does suggest that there's a lot of variability possible in institutional forms in the allocation of the of economic resources and then their deployment under state and some kind of state and community forms. A lot of variation possible. It's still compatible with it being capitalist. And some of those pose alternatives to the to capitalism as a whole, and some don't.
But the, I mean, if, of course, there's enormous institutional variability. But I have two objections. First, that Kenworthy was actually saying that the way in which the redistribution that Sweden attained, the egalitarianism that Sweden attained, was by redistributing worker wages centrally, without jeopardizing profits. So that means that the institutional reform that Sweden settled on was a reform that was specifically constrained by the conditions of reproduction of capitalism. They would not infringe on the conditions of reproduction on, of the economy. And even despite the fact that they did that, Sweden still is undergoing some sort of neoliberal transition to a certain degree, or already has.
Yeah, not much, but
some. Not much, but some.
Right, so but there's a difference between saying there are constraints imposed by the fact that you're living in a world within which capitalism remains dominant for sure and hegemonic in most cases, versus that those constraints are such that you can't actually begin to build alternatives and generate the conditions for transformation inside of that configuration. That it's basically all or nothing, you know, that kind of, you have to wholesale.
Just
right? No. I'm just saying that the rhetoric of it, and that any effort that you do is likely to be eroded and deteriorate over time. This will be at the very core of our discussion in two contexts. One, in Chapter 4, where I lay out the logic of a way of thinking about socialism as strengthening a particular form of economic structure within a hybrid form. And the question is, can you really do that? Are hybrids, that is, combinations of capitalism, statism, and socialism, do they always have to be asymmetrically dominated overwhelmingly by one or another of these forms? And the others merely adapting to forms of compatibility? Or can you have pretty messy, loosely coupled systems with lots of contradictions and it can still muddle through well enough? Now, what's your view about how these different forms get combined? And the traditional Marxian view is pretty restrictive on this score. It has a kind of view of capitalism as a totality and that all other forms are either residual residues from earlier forms, you know, they just haven't disappeared yet, or they are subsumed under capitalism and become functional components of capitalism, but in odd ways. But that there really aren't genuine hybrids is sort of one view. And the other extreme is that kind of anything goes. You can mix and match, you can create all sorts of combinations, and these are all relatively autonomous bits of economic activity, and you need not have any coherence to the system. Well, that's some of the stuff we'll be kind of grappling with.
I think that's the structural discussion about the viability, but also without the agency part of the discussion, because the wealthy people or capitalists or state can use violence or can use the existing means to constrain some alternatives that might work, that economically or socially would work, or would even be a feasible alternative to the system and can be constrained through violence or through other subtle means. that's also an obstacle.
Absolutely.
To take into account.
Yeah, so the question, particularly of violent resistance to experiments and to transformation, that figure will figure a lot in our discussion of strategic logics. The main justification for ruptural strategies, that is, strategies which argue that in order to create the conditions under which we can experiment, you have to have a radical disjuncture in the system as a whole. That if you don't, I just aspirated a the little flaky bits on the outside of an almond. my daughter claims that I never properly learned how to eat.
How long have you been practicing?
It's especially true. Everybody has their vulnerabilities, right? My vulnerability is talking and eating nuts. I like nuts, and nuts are actually quite healthy for me. I eat nuts, and I keep talking, and I forget I'm eating, and then little bits of it go down the wrong tube.
Yeah, actually, that popcorn has nutritional yeast on it, which also tends to make you cough for that same reason.
The little flakes of it kind of get into your airways.
You kind of inhale it.
Yeah. I sort of inhale my food.
It's contagious.
Yeah, see you. The ruptural view is justified by the claim that, look, you've got a choice of either perpetual historical frustration of making small gains which immediately erode, and you can never create a progressive equilibrium, because every advance, the moment you let up your guard, it's going to get undercut, right? So that's the extremely pessimistic view about the possibilities for progressive social change under the existing structure. And therefore, you have to break the basic power relations that organize the system as a whole in order to create the space for experimentation, for the inevitable trial and error process of incremental transformation that would be the bread and butter of any institution building process. So the image is smash first, build later. And the building later will have an incrementalist quality. It'll be trial and error experimentation, lots of wild and interesting things going on. It doesn't have to be coherent after you smash the existing structure of power. That was sort of in the kind of idealized way, the Leninist fantasy, was that you have a new kind of state, and the new kind of state would be foundationally different from the old kind of state, in that it would use coercion only for the purpose of maintaining the conditions for experimentation, not to coerce the experiments themselves. That was the kind of idea. I don't think one can dismiss that position. I don't think it's a Nazi position to hold, even in the complexities of the 21st century. But it does hinge upon the belief that it's possible to actually accomplish a rupture, and that these principles of democratic experimental, of a kind of expansive democratic experimentalism, could survive the necessary costs of transition under ruptural conditions. That is, what it takes to do a rupture in this kind of society, is that compatible with expansive democratic experimentalism on the other side of the rupture? Or would the kinds of coercive authority needed to accomplish a rupture themselves block the possibility of such experimentation afterwards? So I'm relatively skeptical about rupture, not because I think the arguments are silly, but because I think the historical experiences show us how unlikely it is that the post-ruptural conditions will be very satisfactory with respect to a democratic egalitarian project. Now, if you believe that, then you can either say, well, we might as well give up the game. The best we can do is hippie communes in the countryside, sort of retreat from the society and just say, fuck it, I'm not going to have anything to do with it. Professors aren't supposed to say that.
And it's on tape.
Oh, hi there, in Buenos Aires. And thank you, Catherine, for reminding me I better be on better behavior here. And that's going to go on my website, I learned it.
Somebody's going to quit that out of context.
Yeah. We can beep it out.
You know, so you either have to say, whatever, let's retreat, or you have to think about, well, maybe in spite of, you know, the difficulty, there are other strategic logics, and we have to really think in new ways about how to package them and put them together. And that's where, as we will see, we'll be discussing what I'm calling interstitial transformation as a second kind of strategic logic of change, and symbiotic transformation as another, as a third logic of transformation.
I'm so glad you said that, by the way, because I've been wondering how to pronounce that word.
Symbiotic?
Interstitial.
Oh, interstitial. Oh. Oh, good. So it got out before, yeah, before you had to say it first. Yeah, you speak English with such a faint accent that, you know, the one just assumes that it's, you know, homegrown and it's in your bones and, you know.
I still think that we can practice it out more.
Okay. Let's just, we have just a few minutes. I guess the destroy and replace point, Sung Ik, your point we've discussed a little bit here. Let's just talk a little bit about the achievability and viability contrast, because that's another set of ideas that we're going to be playing off of.
But you talk, not me.
I think Julia already well articulated that point and the question and the danger in. You know, where do we then, at what point do we begin to contradict ourselves or compromise the goal or the reasoning for struggling for alternatives? And then at what point does those compromises, can they serve to just reinforce a system that already exists and the domination? So
that's why I really liked that, the other article that you had.
Oh, this is for next week, Back to Socialist Basics.
Oh, that was for this week.
The camping trip paper.
No,
the Back to Socialist Basics has this little camping trip story. That's the one you're talking
about. Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
There's a camping trip.
I missed the camping part. But I thought that it was good because it's always, it sort of reminds you not to forget about why you're fighting for something, because if you get elected and then you got elected for all the wrong reasons, then you won't be able to do what you wanted to anyway, and people will also notice that you're not genuine in wanting to achieve something. So if you're pro-community but you don't run on that basis, then you won't be able to choose what you're going to do, and even worse, you won't be able to get elected because everyone will know you're just sort of making it up.
And, you know, in any kind of project, you have to, you know, you have to attract allies and you have to figure out, you know, who can help you. But, and in that, there's always some level of negotiation. But when does that negotiation become compromise? And when does it set us then back instead of forward? So,
now, on the big picture version of this, which is the one that Julia was, you know, sort of suggesting, when you you ask the question, under what conditions do you think it's most likely that in a complex social structure like developed capitalism, not a simple polarized structure with a homogeneous mass and a small elite, but a very complicated social and economic and political structure like the sort we have, what are the conditions under which breakthroughs to new institutional forms that really expand possibilities for social and political justice, what are the conditions under which that becomes plausible? Is it when you've created the most egalitarian and democratic and, you know, sort of social justice-oriented version of capitalism possible, or where you've refused those moves on the idea that people are more likely to overthrow capitalism when it's as unpleasant as possible? Is it the most pleasant capital, you know, the most humane and egalitarian capitalism, or the most unpleasant one, with its the most brutal inequalities, that is the most likely to be challenged? Now, there's one line of thinking which certainly has intuitive grounding that says it's the most unpleasant forms of capitalism with the greatest amounts of poverty and crime and social conflict that are the most likely to precipitate the mobilizations to overthrow them.
Dimitrov line, right?
What?
Dimitrov line?
Right, yeah, you sort of things have to get worse. But that was a, but see, historically that framework occurred against two other ideas. One, that the crises that capitalism face will get more and more severe, so that you get all of these horrible things happening along with capitalism becoming more and more vulnerable, more and more fragile as a social system, as an economic system. So if you add, as an additional theoretical argument, intensification of economic crisis, then it's possible that the things have to get worse before they get better, that it's only under conditions of mass immiseration and, you know, increased poverty and contradictions that you'll get sufficient in desire for people to overthrow it, and the system gets weak so that they can achieve it. If you drop the intensification of crisis idea, which I think most people, even people who believe that capitalism has endemic tendencies towards crisis, find it hard to argue that there's any reason to believe that they become, that the system becomes more and more fragile, you know, more and more vulnerable to attack. It seems, if anything, to have become rather, I don't know if it's more robust than it was 50 years ago, but it certainly seems perpetually to renew its robustness. So you get rid of that crisis intensification idea. And then you get, where you get these more brutal forms of capitalism, it goes along with increasing complexity, not simplification of the social structure. So the United States has the most brutal form among the developed capitalist worlds. We have the most inequality, the most poverty, the most crime, the most people in prison. But we also have an incredibly complicated class structure. It hasn't, that hasn't gone along with simple polarization. And it seems to me that the characteristic response to the deepening social problems here is fear by very substantial parts of the population in that social structure, and a desire to strengthen the repressive capacity of the state, not challenge it. So, I mean, putting all those things together, I think, in fact, if I could snap my finger and make the United States like Sweden, you know, if I could just do that, and we'd have all Swedish institutions, we'd be in a much better, not worse, position to argue for more advanced forms of democracy and equality. You know, Sweden is a better platform under which to then think about how can we try some new experiments here, how can we create some new institutional spaces, and how can we jigger the system in ways that actually opens up new possibilities in the future. I can snap my fingers. It doesn't. I've tried it for years, you know. It doesn't.
The alchemy of finger snapping.
I had in my.
You have to think about
this. This may seem like a completely irrelevant anecdote, but in my freshman year in college, I took a physics course that was way too hard for me. You know, I barely passed it. But at the first day of class, the professor held up an apple, and he said, "There's a finite probability in the course of this lecture that this apple will spontaneously turn into a battleship, because in quantum mechanics, you know, anything can spontaneously change into anything else. It's all just," and he added, "but it's never happened." I feel like that about
changing the United States.
Well, there's a finite probability that apple could turn into a battleship. There's a finite chance that the United States could turn into Sweden.
Yeah. much more finite.
I think the more atoms involved, the decreasing.
I guess it's a little harder. It is 7:05. I think we're pretty well launched. I thought this was. And I should say, in terms of just kind of everybody participating, I think everybody spoke a couple of times at least, and nobody seemed eager to dominate and put down everybody. You know, a lot of people had a lot of energy to talk. This is all augurs very well for an engaging semester. So next week it's What's So Bad About Capitalism. I would encourage you, as you write your interrogations, to really kind of try to focus. It's not that they have to be short. I don't mind them being long if you want to really elaborate your points. But really try to keep in mind that I go from here to here, and so, and one way you can help me is you can tell me, okay, here is the agenda item. You know, you can do some of the work for telling me what you want me to put on the agenda. You know, and then all of that is the elaboration. You know, and I may decide that you haven't quite captured your own agenda quite right. Now, that happens. You know, in the sense that I may feel like a slight tweaking of it makes it a better point of entry for a discussion.
They cannot speak for themselves. They must be spoken for.
But you know, if you keep that in mind, I think it might help. All right. I don't think I have any other business. I will be, well, Rudolph and I will be meeting a half hour early to hopefully get us connected to Buenos Aires.
I hope that would work. Yeah.
Turn the Haven Center into Argentina.
Yeah.
Somebody would...